This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Apparently, few people took the relationship seriously when the esteemed writer Christopher Isherwood became involved with Don Bacardi, who was still a teenager, about 30 years younger than Isherwood. But the relationship lasted over 30 years, until Isherwood's death in 1986. Their story is the subject of the documentary Chris and Don, which is now out on DVD. Our guest is Don Bacardi. His life with Christopher Isherwood reveals something of what it was like to be openly gay in Hollywood in the 50s and 60s. Isherwood was a British writer who became an American citizen in 1946. He's best known for his short story collection, The Berlin Stories, based on his experiences living in Berlin just before World War II. The Broadway show and movie musical Cabaret were adapted from those stories. So were the play and film I Am a Camera. Isherwood also co-wrote several screenplays, including Rage in Heaven and The Loved One. With Isherwood's encouragement, Don Bacardi became a portrait painter. His work is in the permanent collections of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Smithsonian, and the National Portrait Gallery in London. Terry spoke with Don Bacardi last summer when Chris and Don was released.
Don Bacardi, welcome to Fresh Air. That must have been a real emotional experience for you, being in this documentary, immersing yourself in an earlier part of your life and in your relationship with the late Christopher Isherwood.
Yes, it was, and it still is. Every time I see it, I can't help being moved by it. That early footage of Chris and me seems very touching to me now.
But you're so young.
Yes, indeed I was.
When you
looked even younger than I was.
You're right. How old were you?
18.
So,
and that same year, I went with Chris to New York for the first time, and a serious rumor went around town that Christopher had brought a 12-year-old with him from California. And people believed it, and I looked the part.
Okay, so you were 18 when you started seeing each other, and he was 30 years older. Did you think of yourself as gay at that point? Had you had gay relationships before? Were you certain of your sexual orientation?
Oh, I was certain. I'd had a few encounters, but I was still relatively green in my experience, but I certainly knew without a doubt that I was queer.
What was your first reaction to the 30-year age difference between you and Christopher Isherwood? Did that seem like a lot to you? Did he seem way older than you?
He was actually a year older than my father, but he didn't seem so. He seemed ages younger. And he seemed really out of the category of anybody that I might consider for a sexual relationship. But he was so boyish in his look and so witty and charming. And I felt at ease with him almost immediately. And it wasn't until many years later that I realized that in many respects, Chris was much younger than I. He was much more curious. He was still capable of being awed by his experience like a young man. And that was really quite sobering for me to realize.
What were some of the difficulties of being in a relationship when you were young, still a teenager, and unformed? And your partner was an older, established writer with a circle of friends and colleagues, many of them celebrities. Did it make you insecure at all? Did you have an identity crisis?
Social situations were sometimes difficult, but then Chris was always there to shore me up. And I felt his support. He never let me flounder. And the fact that I was in his company meant that I didn't have to worry about making conversation because he was a wonderful conversationalist. And that allowed me to drink in everybody that I met. And that was very exciting because often they were the very movie stars that I'd idolized since I was a child.
Because you were so much younger, did some of his friends think that you were just a toy for him?
Oh, yes. I looked like a toy boy. And well, I enjoyed their interest in me for my looks. Yes, of course, all young people want to be taken seriously as mature personalities. But I was quite pleased to be admired physically. But as I got older, I wanted more, and that was good because it made me think seriously about how I could make something of myself.
One of the interviewees in the movie, Chris and Don, says about you, it was if Chris had cloned himself because you'd picked up some of his mannerisms and some of his British accent. Were you aware of that at the time?
Well, I gradually realized that I was, and still am, an unconscious mimic, that I instinctively took on the sounds of people I was around with a lot. And that happened very early with Chris. Within a year, I believe, I was already beginning to sound a bit like him. But I wasn't aware of it and got a big shock when I first heard my voice recorded. And there were several people in the room, and I looked around and said, "I don't sound like that, do I?" And they all agreed, "Yes, yes, that sounds exactly like you." And I was horrified because I knew that people who'd known me before I knew Chris would think I'd become wildly affected. But since I couldn't hear it myself, there was little I could do about it.
Do you think he saw things in you that you didn't yet see in yourself?
Yes, I know he did, and he tried to help me to see them and to believe in myself. Like many young people, I was lacking in confidence. I was shy. Well, my mother was extremely shy, and I think I'd been mimicking her for years. And my instinctive mimicry, it was only years later that I realized that that was a very important aspect of my work as an artist. I always drew pictures of people and only people, and I began to realize that I was mimicking them, my idols, when I was working with them. Well, because I had the wonderful experience of being able to draw from life many of the people I'd drawn from magazine pictures when I was a child.
Christopher Isherwood sent you to art school when he realized that you had talent. And you loved art school, and you developed into a painter and sketch artist doing, portraits of people. Did it change your relationship with Christopher Isherwood when you became an artist in your own right?
Oh, it was a very important change from my point of view because I'd found my vocation. And once I got to art school, I worked at it day and night. I went all day long, and I was often back for the evening class. And it was of great importance to me to establish my own identity. And I knew that I had to do that if the relationship between us was to be preserved.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Don Bacardi. And the new movie, Chris and Don, is about his 33-year relationship with the writer Christopher Isherwood. You were both always out as a couple. You never pretended that you were heterosexual. You showed up at parties together. What was it like to be out in Hollywood? And Christopher Isherwood was writing for Hollywood. What was it like to be out in Hollywood in the 50s and 60s, before Stonewall, before the gay liberation movement?
Well, I suppose, without realizing it, we were early pioneers. But we had really very little choice. First of all, Chris was a distinguished writer who was fairly well known to be homosexual. So anybody that he appeared with frequently was assumed, especially if he were youthful and presentable, was presumed to be a boyfriend. And we weren't going to pretend that we weren't living together, so it would have been unnatural for Chris to leave me at home, and he wouldn't dream of doing that anyway because he was an above-board personality. He wasn't about to cringe just because he was engaged in a relationship that was frowned on by society. He was, in his heart, a genuine rebel.
You and Christopher Isherwood were friends with the actor Tony Perkins. And my understanding is that he was trying hard not to be gay. He was married, had a child. Was he in therapy trying to, you know, like overcome gayness? And did you watch him go through difficult periods?
Oh, I think he spent years on therapy and hoping that he could transform himself into a heterosexual. Thank goodness that was never a problem for either Chris or me. And in fact, everything that I value in my life has come to me through my queerness. And I've had an extremely lucky life. So we understood Perkins and sympathized with him, but that was certainly not a feeling that we suffered from. We both, Chris and I, were very, very pleased to be queer.
Don Bacardi speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's interview with artist Don Bacardi. His relationship with British writer Christopher Isherwood is the subject of the documentary Chris and Don, which is now out on DVD.
The movie Cabaret and the Broadway show Cabaret are both based on a short story that Christopher Isherwood wrote, based on somebody who he met in the 1930s when he was living in Berlin. And in the movie, you say that Isherwood didn't really like the show that much because Liza Minnelli was just such a terrific singer in Cabaret, and the character of Sally Bowles is supposed to be a real amateur. So it was hard to square those two things. But what did you both think of the whole idea of turning the short story about Sally Bowles into a musical?
Well, it's so easy to lose the character of Sally Bowles because as soon as she's played by a very talented professional actress and singer, as Liza Minnelli is, you lose an essential quality of Sally Bowles because she was nothing if she wasn't an amateur. And Liza Minnelli would have been the toast of Europe, belting those songs out. How could she possibly also be little no talent Sally Bowles, however charming she is? And, of course, Chris couldn't help being aware of that. Before he saw the movie, he actually thought Liza Minnelli might be very good casting. We'd seen her in two films, The Sterile Cuckoo and Junie Moon, and she was clearly very talented. He thought she might be just wonderful. But as soon as she comes on belting those songs, he said she's not Sally Bowles.
You went through a period in your relationship with Christopher Isherwood, and this is described in the documentary about your relationship, Chris and Don. You went through a period when you insisted that you needed to see other men, that Isherwood had had a period of his life before he met you when he had other relationships, and you needed to go through that period too. So how did you both deal with jealousy and possessiveness? Was that easy or difficult?
Very difficult, but because it required the maximum of tact and consideration and delicacy, and always I felt the responsibility, and I know Chris did too, to whomever we were seeing on the side, to always make it clear to the other that he was and always would be number one. If one keeps that in mind, I do think one could do miracle turns around jealousy and resentment. But I myself was always very careful to let Chris know there was no question that anybody would ever mean to me what he did.
When Christopher Isherwood was dying of prostate cancer, you took care of him. You also sketched him. You did a series of, I think it was pen and ink drawings on his deathbed. Why did you want to spend those last few days of his life at his side drawing him?
Well, I always intended to look after him and keep him home, keep him out of a hospital. That was his idea of a horrible death, a death in a hospital. So for many, many years, that was my intention. And then when he got sick and began to fail, we were often in the house alone together. And yes, there were things I did for him, but what about the rest of my day? So I canceled all my sittings. The last 6 months of his life, I only worked with him. And I worked with him almost every day and often did as many as a dozen drawings a day, fast ones, slow ones, the best I could manage.
Did that kind of provide a structure for you both to be together and yet not have to talk? And
well, exactly. And you see, when I work with anybody, as I was speaking earlier, the mimicry, the identification with my sitter that is instinctive and a very necessary part of my working technique, I was identifying with Chris even after 33 years, and I was with him more intensely than I could be doing anything else. And so it began to seem like dying was something that we were doing together. I was with him. I was looking into his eyes and feeling him as well as looking at him. And that was so important to me. There was no other way I could have been so intimate with him. And that was wonderful for me. I was there in a way that was much more intense than if I just stood by the bed looking at him. I was copying him. So I was with him the whole time.
In some of the sketches that you did of him when he was dying, he looks like he's in pain. And I was wondering if you let him...
He was.
Yeah, I was wondering if you let him see those drawings or if you wanted to protect him from looking at how pained he appeared to be. I mean, obviously he knew he was in pain, but sometimes it's not helpful to see how you look when you feel that way.
Well, you see, it's my habit to ask my sitters to sign and date my pictures of them because I feel the way I work is a perfect collaboration. And the better my sitter is, the stiller, the more concentrated my sitter, the better the work I do is likely to turn out. And when I began to concentrate only on Chris those last 6 months, he signed and dated the pictures I did for the first 3 or 4 months, and then he got beyond it. He couldn't sign and date anymore. So one day, he was in bed, and I'd done 6 or 7 pictures, and they were all black acrylic, and the paint was still wet. So I'd spread some of the pictures on the bed and some of them on the floor, and I was used by that time to his not being able to sign and date the pictures, so I hadn't even suggested it. And in fact, as I was picking up the pictures, being sure that they were dry, holding them up to the light, I thought he was asleep. And when I got the pictures together and was on my way out of the bedroom with them under my arm, he said to me from his bed, "I like the ones of him dying." And that absolutely threw me. I thought, my goodness, he's with me still. He's still urging me on, praising me for drawings of him dying. Now, I don't know, I've never heard of anybody else capable of that kind of consideration in the state that he was in.
Don Bacardi speaking with Terry Gross. Bacardi's relationship with writer Christopher Isherwood is the subject of the documentary Chris and Don, now out on DVD. Bacardi will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. We're listening to Terry's interview with Don Bacardi, whose relationship with writer Christopher Isherwood is the subject of the documentary Chris and Don, which is now out on DVD. When they fell in love, Isherwood was in his late 40s. Bacardi was 18. Terry spoke with Don Bacardi last summer.
Marriage wasn't close to being legal for gay people when you and Christopher Isherwood were a couple. But if, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think this is when he was sick, he adopted you so that you could make medical and legal decisions on his behalf, because that was your only way of having some kind of legal relationship that would be recognized for things like medical decisions. How strange was that, that he had to, like, adopt you in order for you to have a legal family connection to you?
Well, even though I was determined to keep him home when he got sick, there was a chance that he would have to go into hospital for some reason or other, and we were both worried that I wouldn't be given access. That was the only reason we adopted each other.
Did it work? You know, was it recognized in the way that you wanted it to be? Did it accomplish what you needed it to accomplish?
Well, it didn't really come into it. He did have to spend a few days in hospital during those last 6 months, and I just had a cot put in the room, and I slept beside his bed. But it didn't really enter into it. I never got anyone saying, you can't go into his room. But I know Chris would have cheered when gays were given the right to marry. We would both consider that a huge triumph, but it wouldn't have changed our attitude. We both of us agreed early on that any kind of legalization of our relationship was just not necessary for either of us.
I was reading an article from 1997 in the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Review. And in that 1997 article about you, it described you as having a partner who was 26 years younger than you, an age difference that was similar to the difference between you and Christopher Isherwood. And you were quoted as saying, "I couldn't find anybody to replace Chris, so I thought I'd try and find somebody who could play my role. So now I'm playing Chris." Are you still in that relationship?
No. It lasted for 10 years, and many of those 10 years were blissful years for me. And yes, he was 26 years younger than I, and so I got this extraordinary experience of playing Chris's role with a much younger man, and it was so illuminating of all of my years with Chris. And I was so often saying to myself when my young friend and I, he's asked me not to name him, that's why I'm being coy about his name, when he and I would have quarrels or disagreements, or when we'd come together blissfully, I was always addressing Chris in my mind, saying, "Oh, that's what that situation was about. That's how you were feeling. Now I understand." And that was just, I believe it's called Epiphany. Well, if that's what it's called, Epiphany is great.
Are you in a relationship now?
I'm, for the first time in my life, having a very satisfactory relationship with somebody my own age. We were born the same year, 1934, and he's actually 3 months my junior. And he was somebody that I met on one of my trips to New York more than 40 years ago. And, of course, I was always frank with the people I had sex with in those years. And how could I not be? Because Chris was well known, and I, as his friend, I couldn't not be frank. So when the job that I was doing in New York was over, I came back to California, and I never saw this friend again until about 3.5, 4 years ago. I had a show at the Huntington, and he went to see it and wrote me a letter telling me how much he'd enjoyed it. So I wrote him back and said, why don't you come and sit for me again? I'd done drawings of him more than 40 years before, both portraits and nudes, and he did come to sit for me. And he rung the buzzer up at the gate, and I went out the house, and down the stairs came this man of my own age. Now, that was quite a surprise. And then I thought, well, what do you suppose he's seeing? He's seeing a man of his age, too. It was a charming reunion, and we did several sittings together, and now we spend a lot of time together and very much enjoy each other's company. So that's a pretty good development from my point of view.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Don Bacardi speaking with Terry Gross. Bacardi's relationship with writer Christopher Isherwood is the subject of the documentary Chris and Don, which is now out on DVD. While some filmmakers become known for a particular style or genre, the work of director Jonathan Demme is striking in its sheer eclecticism. His films range from comedies like Married to the Mob to an exploration of AIDS discrimination in Philadelphia to his horror classic The Silence of the Lambs, which won 5 Oscars in 1992. He's also done documentaries, including the concert film Stop Making Sense with Talking Heads and Heart of Gold featuring Neil Young, and his 2007 film Jimmy Carter, Man from Plains. Demme's latest film, Rachel Getting Married, is a family drama shot in documentary style. It's just come out on DVD. The screenplay was written by Jenny Lamette, daughter of director Sidney Lamette and granddaughter of Lena Horne. Rachel Getting Married stars Anne Hathaway, who plays Kim, a young woman coming home from a drug rehab center to attend her sister Rachel's wedding. Kim's reentry into the family leads to a number of painful confrontations and arguments in the middle of the wedding festivities, mostly between Kim and her sister Rachel. In this scene, the sisters are fighting, and their father is helplessly trying to bring them under control.
I mean, in the language of psychology, one could say you both suffer from acute boundary issues.
Rachel, it is very nice that you're getting your PhD, but don't be patronizing. I'm sorry, but it's ugly, honey, and it's not becoming to you.
Well, how come she gets to spout off about paternal sibling issues, but God forbid I should even reference the boundary thing, even though I actually know what I'm talking about?
By the way, I'm not in crisis. I haven't been in crisis in a year.
You just got out of rehab.
Oh, God. Why is this so difficult for you to understand? Rehabilitation, crisis. You should really learn the difference. Right. No, it's like you're not happy unless I'm in some kind of a desperate situation. You have no idea what to do with me unless I'm in crisis. But why am I the only one willing to say this?
You know, you are so much more evolved in your suffering.
I'm not. Who is talking about
your
that?
Your suffering is not the most important thing to
who
everybody.
Who is saying it is?
I have a life. I'm in school. I'm getting married. I'm...
What?
I'm pregnant.
What? You're pregnant? You are pregnant now?
Are you sure?
Oh, my God!
What? Oh, my God!
I spoke to Jonathan Demme and Jenny Lamette last fall when Rachel Getting Married was released. Now, Jonathan Demme, this film is shot in a documentary style. I mean, we see a lot of handheld cameras in which, you know, the camera follows dialogue from one to another. Explain your approach in shooting this film.
Well, I think two things probably more than anything else. One is that over the years, I put a lot of energy into trying to find the most time-honored way of bringing the audience into a scene through very sort of, you know, with an eye on Hitchcock techniques and stuff like that, and really kind of, I think, sort of it, on my own terms, quote-unquote, perfecting it. And meanwhile, Mean Streets was the first time where I really kind of went, wow, and saw, gosh, look at the way this picture's been shot, you know, and the immediacy of that handheld camera and stuff. And, you know, the handheld camera's been around before Martin Scorsese showed up, especially in, you know, the Nouvelle Vague and the films of John Cassavetes. But there was this urgency, and I felt myself feeling like, wow, this is really happening the way Scorsese used it. So I've kind of admired that, and I always try to get a little handheld into the movie. And then more recently, I've been shooting a lot of documentaries with Declan Quinn,
right,
one of the great cinematographers of all time. And after we did we did a documentary together about Jimmy Carter, Man from Plains, about a year and a half ago. And coming off of that, the way that Declan's able to make what's really going on in real life feels so incredibly immediate and cinematic, made me think, well, gosh, let's shoot a Rachel getting married like that. Let's pretend we're making a documentary. In fact, we won't even rehearse, and we had to cast actors who were willing to not rehearse, to not know when the camera was going to be on them. And the kind of feedback we were getting there from the actors was that they were really, really excited about working this way, that it really helped keep the spontaneity factor in full effect, that by not having, you know, blocked out shots and then repeated blocked out shots as we would try to perfect every angle, it kept them feeling as much as possible that this was really going on. And, you know, one thing that Declan and I thought would be great, and one thing he really wanted to do, was operating on the premise that almost every single scene here, in theory, someone could have had a little home movie camera with them, including the family arguments. And if one was perverse enough, they could film these little arguments. And that's just the way it went forth.
This film has something which is unique in cinema, as far as I know, which is a duel on who can best load a dishwasher. Which is a funny moment at which Rachel's dad and, I guess, the groom in the wedding get into this argument about who knows how to better load a dishwasher. Jenny Lumet, where does that come from?
That is completely pilfered. I grew up how I grew up, and it wasn't like, you know, famous people were crawling out from under the sink when I got home from school. But every now and again, there was a great artist in the house, and one time the director, Bob Fosse, was in the house for dinner. And so you have to – this is a very – Bob Fosse is – I was a little girl. I was 11 or 12. And this is a very languid, long, graceful man. And the whole being sort of ends and extends to the cigarette in the fingertips and sort of ends with the cigarette in the fingertips. And even the smoke is graceful around this man. And he has – dressed all in black, black cashmere sweater over the shoulders, you know, black shirt, black pants, and this beautiful goatee. And there is my dad, who looks like a cantaloupe, completely spherical, with like a big tummy, wearing a sweatsuit with like vinaigrette stains all over him. And there, it's after dinner, and my dad's loading the dishwasher. And Bob Fosse takes a big drag of this, you know, a Galois or whatever it was he was smoking, goes, "You know, Sydney, if you put the salad bowls in the upper level, you'll get 10% more stuff in your dishwasher." And my dad, who is 5'3", looks up at him and goes, "Bob, go boom, boom, boom." Because I don't think I can say it on the radio.
Right.
And so there we have this. And for the next hour and a half, these guys who one would think would have something else to talk about other than loading the dishwasher, went at it like two people caught in the grips of the worst OCD on the planet, with Bob Fosse turning the tines on the fork upside down and calling Sydney a barbarian and Sydney saying, oh, you're a, what do you know, dancer boy? I mean, it was so demented, so demented. And I did not remember it because I am prescient and thought, aha, I will use this, you know, decades later. I remembered it because it was psychotic and disturbing behavior.
We're listening back to a recent interview with screenwriter Jenny Lamette and director Jonathan Demme. Their film Rachel Getting Married has just come out on DVD. I also talked to Demme about his 1991 Academy Award-winning film The Silence of the Lambs, starring Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster. Let's hear a clip from the film.
Dr. Lecter, whose head is in that bottle?
Why don't you ask me about Buffalo Bill?
Do you know something about him?
I might if I saw the case file. You could get that for me.
Why don't we talk about Miss Moffat? You wanted me to find him.
His real name is Benjamin Raspail, a former patient of mine whose romantic attachments ran to, shall we say, the exotic. I did not kill him, I assure you, merely tucked him away very much as I found him after he'd missed three appointments.
But if you didn't kill him, then who did, sir?
Who can say? Best thing for him, really. His therapy was going nowhere.
I wanted to talk just a little bit about The Silence of the Lambs. It's the film, it goes back a few years in your career, 1991, but it swept the Oscars. And I read in an interview at the time that Janet Maslin said that it was your opinion that every director dreams of making a film more terrifying than anything he has ever seen. Is that true, or was that just something you tossed off at the time?
Well, I'll tell you, what I can tell you is that I know when I saw Zodiac, and then again when I saw No Country for Old Men, there was a moment in each of my viewing experiences where I went, damn it, this is scarier than Silence of the Lambs. So I guess on a certain level that there's something there, yes.
You've been topped again. Oh, God.
Yeah.
One of the hallmarks of some of your films is shooting scenes where characters look directly into the camera or almost directly into the camera. And I'm wondering, is there a particular reason or purpose for that technique when you use it? I mean, I see it in The Manchurian Candidate, the film you did a few years ago.
Yes. that is the use of the subjective camera is an idea that's been around in movies for a long, long time. And it's an idea that was seized on very notably by Sam Fuller and by Alfred Hitchcock and two different very kind of otherwise very different styles of filmmaking. And the whole point, according to Hitchcock, and it's right, is that, you know, if you go subjective camera, you are, for that moment, putting the audience in the shoes of the character. You're showing the audience and making the audience share exactly what it's like to see what the character sees. So Tak Fujimoto and I, when we started getting enough of a budget where we could afford the right lenses, because we started out doing low-budget pictures together, we started experimenting with this subjective camera thing, and we kind of fell in love with the idea of using that as as our close-up. Instead of having the camera slightly off to the side, our thing was, well, maybe by using subjective camera in ordinary dialogue situations, you know, we can bring the audience that deeply into the film that way. And we were afraid that it might be kind of off-putting or call attention to itself. But we found out, Married to the Mob was the first time we did it, and nobody commented. The scenes that we used it went really well. No one found fault with it. So when we did Silence of the Lambs, we really went to town with it. We just started using subjective camera for every dialogue scene, trying to pull the audience deeply as you possibly could into the scene. So it was really an aggressive way to pursue intense audience involvement. Now, in this movie, we didn't use, in Rachel Getting Married, there's no subjective camera. This
right.
time, the energy and the effort to draw the audience as deeply as possible into the movie comes from making them feel that what they're seeing actually happened. And in this way, we try to take advantage of that kind of that truth factor that comes along with looking at your home movies. This really happened. Look how shaky the camera is. Or we tried to make it too shaky. But that's how we tried to really galvanize the audience into believing what they were seeing and to getting as involved as possible.
Director Jonathan Demme. We also spoke with screenwriter Jenny Lamette. Their film Rachel Getting Married, starring Anne Hathaway, is now out on DVD. Among the movies opening this week are I Love You, Man, a comedy starring Paul Rudd and Jason Segel, and the industrial spy drama Duplicity, the second film by Tony Gilroy, who made Michael Clayton. Duplicity pairs Julia Roberts and Clive Owen. Unable to decide between thriller and bromance, critic David Edelstein gives us a twofer and reviews both films.
This week at the Multiplex, we have a slob comedy and a swank corporate espionage thriller. They're both pretty good, and if you can't get into one, you'll have a fine enough time at the other. I Love You, Man takes an overfamiliar premise and inverts it. In Judd Apatow movies like Knocked Up, a child man enters into a grown-up relationship with a woman and has to face up to adult responsibilities, which means balancing buddydom and domesticity, a classic theme since Diner. The gimmick here is a protagonist, Peter Klavan, played by Paul Rudd, who's slightly effeminate, mature to a fault, engaged to a woman, and who doesn't have close male friends, which won't make for much of a swinging bachelor party. He needs what the movie calls mandates. The question of hetero man love is central to I Love You, Man. What do these filmmakers think it really is? It's unresolved, but a clue comes in writer-director John Hamburg's so-so 2004 comedy Along Came Polly, in which a squeamish Ben Stiller plays basketball with large, shirtless men and finds his face mashed up against a wobbly, sweaty, hairy, moly man belly. Very peculiar, this horror over physical contact with males. I Love You, Man gestures broadly toward the notion of homosexual panic. Peter has a gay brother, played by Andy Samberg, so the issue is in the air. Then Jason Segel's big, unkempt Sidney Fife lumbers into one of realtor Peter's open houses for the free food, and they bond over Sidney's scrutiny of male body language.
Look, that guy needs to fart. It's pretty clear, but he doesn't know her well enough to do it in front of her, so I assume they haven't slept together.
He does seem to be clenching.
Yeah, he doesn't want to fart. Watch, when he gets enough space, he can let one rip, I guarantee you. Oh, that's a good move. Hey, go check out the kitchen, honey. I'll meet you in there.
Okay, yeah.
Now watch. He's making his move slowly, slowly but surely. Watch the leg. Wait for it. Wait for it. Fart. Boom. That's a fart. That's a fart.
Oh, my God.
Look at him. Crop dusting across your open house. It's a disgrace.
He farted in my open house.
He sure did.
You know what, guy? I like it, but I'm thinking it might be a little bit small.
Totally, and it smells like fart.
Segel is a howl, and Sidney, a fascinating enigma. Is he a finance whiz or a con man? An easygoing Lothario or a twisted freak? Is he closeted? The movie finally ducks that question, but it does give Rudd his breakout role. The actor uses his soft face to generate an astounding amount of sympathy. Watch him miss high fives and mangle attempts to add bro or dude to sentences, then wince in horror at the lameness of such lines as, "Hey, Von Duderino." Over on the other screen, Clive Owen, in the corporate con game thriller Duplicity, does better with banter. Here he is meeting up with Julia Roberts after she seduced him 5 years earlier. Or did she?
How do I know you?
How do you know me? Wow, that's tough. That's a strong play. Believe me, I've spent a lot of time thinking what this would be like. Where we'd be, what I'd say, what you'd say, but I never thought that you'd...
I'm terribly sorry.
You really want to go this way?
You clearly have me confused with someone else.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not great on names. I should be. I try. Faces, I'm definitely better. Faces, I'm like a B, B minus. Where I'm good, where I really excel, people I've slept with. That's been a traditional area of strength for me.
Look, seriously, I don't know who you think I am, but...
You charm me, seduce me, then you drug me and ransack my hotel room. And how sick is this? You know, the last thing I remember before I passed out was how much I liked you.
Roberts is coming off a disastrous Broadway debut, and she's tight. She's even more self-protective than usual. But that works here, because she's a CIA agent turned corporate double agent, and we're not sure what she really thinks. Does she fall for Owen's character, or is she playing him? If Duplicity were a David Mamet movie, you'd have no doubt. But writer-director Tony Gilroy is half conspiracy theorist, half romantic. And if anyone could break through Roberts' tense mask, it's the wolfish yet needy Owen. All his emotions are on the surface and in her face. The plot revolves around rival corporations, with CEOs played by Paul Giamatti and Tom Wilkinson, who have a crazy hatred for each other and want to steal each other's secrets. Gilroy goes in for split screens and a blasting score and does loop-de-loops with the syntax. There's an overture, then it's 5 years later, then 2 years earlier, then next week. It's a brain teaser. You don't see the big picture until the end. Much of Duplicity is laborious, and you can't figure out if you're supposed to root for Roberts and Owen, who are, after all, thieves. But the disorientation itself is fun. With all the scoundrels in the markets, it's nice to get conned and not lose more than $10, plus popcorn.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.